The Attorney General wishes to announce that the following program has been rated
liberal rubbish
by the Department of Justice.
All right, guard, begin the unnecessarily slow-moving dipping mechanism.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Isn't he simply adorable, Pop?
I told you, never trust a monkey!
Listen, you smell something?
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourselves down!
Welcome to episode 16 of the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your host, Joe Vecchio, doing the working man's thing here at 3 a.m. on Tuesday, because I was busy. I was burning a CD for my coworker. You know, they asked me, and this is something I want to talk about for a little bit. They asked me to come in to work a little early today because the day shift people, because I work mid shift, as you know, 3:30 to midnight, and the day shift people had some sort of meeting going on at 2 o'clock. So I wonder if it's the same production meeting that we had about a week ago. At any rate, they said, if you could, come in early, and I said, yes, sure. They had actually wanted me to work on Saturday, but I had other things to do. And normally, you know, normally I would work overtime. I don't mind working a little OT, but, you know, the other thing was that, now again, I work till midnight, okay, midnight. And I don't have a car. I mean, I got a ride home, which is nice, but the same guy can't pick me up. So getting to work is a pain in the butt to begin with. It usually takes me about an hour and a half to get there by bus, and it takes me 15 minutes to get home by car. That just goes to show where public transportation in Atlanta is. But I get off at midnight, and the only times I had available for working overtime would be to come in at like 5:30 a.m. or 7 a.m. And what kind of choice is that? I mean, how am I supposed to, you know, come home, I get home around 12:15, and I'm all still, you know, all wound up from work, so I'm not going to get to sleep right away. And then just go out and sleep for maybe 3 or 4 hours at the most, and come right back in again, you know, because I have to catch, and I don't even know, you know, I don't even know what the bus schedule is on Saturday. I may not be able to get there at 7 o'clock in the morning. So at any rate, I had other things to do. But when they asked me to work overtime on Saturday, they also asked if I can come in early on Monday, and I said, yeah, I'll come in early. You know, no big deal. I don't mind. You know, 2 o'clock. So I come in, and I'm out there on the paint line pulling stuff off the line. And of course, since they had three of us over there, naturally they grabbed me to go up front. They had me hanging stuff out. You know, hanging stuff is different from taking stuff off the line. Some of the bigger items, I generally don't mind a little bit of heavy lifting because we get some fairly large items. But when you're taking them off the line, generally, you can use both hands, both arms to do it. You grab it, you know, and you can pull it off and hold it with both arms. But when you're hanging stuff, there's two things. Number one, since the hooks are a little fairly high, I have, if I'm grabbing a heavy box, and that's what I kind of had to load on there, some of the heavier boxes, I can really only use one hand because you have to hold the hook steady in order to fit it into the hole. You know, you can't just lay it in there. You gotta put the hook, you got to hold the hook steady, and that means lifting up. Usually I lift up my left arm because I'm left-handed. It's just easier for me. I'd have more trouble holding it with my right hand. Now, that wouldn't be so bad because these boxes, some of these are fairly large, and it wouldn't be so bad doing that if I could hold the thing lower on the box and lift it up from there. But you can't do that with the raw metal because the raw metal is all greased up and stuff. I don't want to say greased up, but, you know, because it comes right off the machine generally, there's a kind of grease, and the metal itself is kind of slick. So it's very difficult to hold. Plus, it ruins your damn gloves, you know, and we have certain types of gloves that we use at work, and that that are great if you're working on objects that are already painted, because you can grip it strongly and, you know, it's got a nice rubber thing. But when you're working with the raw metal, it tends to ruin the gloves because all the grease and stuff eventually seeps in there. And you have to go through you usually use at least one set of gloves a day. I mean, depending on where you're working in the front, you got to go through one or two. And when I was working in the assembly line on day shift back in last summer, I was actually using two pairs of gloves a day because there's so much grease going through. And I can get away with a lot more usage. I can get a lot more usage out of my gloves if I'm working where I'm usually working, taking stuff off the line. So here I am. It's like an hour and a half before I normally come in, and I'm sitting there. My shoulder is killing me. My left shoulder, which, you know, is not in the best of shape to begin with. In fact, both of my shoulders are kind of screwy. They tell me that it's a rotator cuff injury, but I don't like to use that term because it makes it sound like I have some big famous sports injury, because that's what, when pitchers throw their arms out, that's what basically the muscle is, the cartilage. And that hurts me every time I have to lift that stuff. And I'm getting a little tired of getting taken advantage of, because every time there's like three people over where I'm at, they grab me. They say, Joe, come on, we need your help somewhere else. And first of all, when they have three people hanging stuff, it's hard for two people to keep up. Okay, granted, when Chris was there, Chris and Dave could handle all that stuff for the most part. But you're putting more pressure on them, and there's no need to put pressure on them to do this. And, I'm sitting there. I'm listening to the bell go off, because there's a bell that goes off when you have to stop the line because of whatever reason. And I'm like, I know that they're having trouble on that end, because, you know, Dave and Chris are not there. It's two other people who don't know anything about pulling stuff off the line who are there. And they're not, you know, doing as efficient a job. So they're going to have more trouble keeping up with stuff. So here I am, killing my shoulder, hanging these friggin' parts on the line. And back on where I'm working, on the other end of it, they have other people who can't keep up because they don't have an experienced person. They're not that I'm the fastest person in the world, but there was a point in time where this sort of thing was going on for like 3 weeks, every single night for 3 weeks, because it was Chris there and Dave there and I. They would call me off and have me go somewhere else and do something. Look, I don't mind helping out if there's an emergency somewhere, if you got a hot item that you need some help. I don't really mind. But every day for 3 weeks was getting ridiculous. I was getting to the point where it was apparent to my boss, at any rate, that where I'm supposed to be working, the job I was hired to do, is just like a staging area for what they really want me to do. And Chris left. Chris left because he got a dream job. For him, he works for football now. He works for NFL Europe, and he's a trainee coach and intern. And he's doing very well, from what I understand. He calls Dave every now and then, and, you know, we think it's great. He's doing a job that he loves. And, you know, and I'm going to say, for selfish reasons, it's good that he's there, because now with only the two of us on the line, they can't be pulling me off, because you can't leave one person on the line like that. But I'm getting a little sick and tired of being taken advantage of. Now, any of you who listen to the show, and I don't know how many people listen. I probably get maybe I don't have a way of keeping track of who's actually downloading the show or streaming the show. So I really don't know how many listeners I have. But if you're listening, and especially if you're listening at work, how many times has this happened to you? Where they just make you do extra stuff or stuff that you're not, you know, really supposed to be doing, and just and if you do it, then they just make you do it more and they take advantage of you. I mean, does that happen to you all the time? I know it happens to me all the time, and I know it happens to other people. In fact, when I came in early to work one day, I was like 15 minutes before I was supposed to start. And there's some stuff coming down the line, another guy doing it, and I'm starting to help him out a little bit. And he says, no, don't do that. I said, don't help out, because, you know, if you start helping out, they'll just make you do more of it. And as much as I'm the type of person who likes to do a little extra, who doesn't mind, you know, helping out, the guy's absolutely right, because you know something? The bosses don't appreciate it. When you get in a position where you got a hard worker, somebody works hard, they don't necessarily get anything. And all this libertarian crap about, you know, the people, you know, who work hardest will always get the benefits and stuff like that, that's not necessarily true. Especially if you're in the regular workforce, if you're just considered to be, you know, an hourly idiot worker, they have little respect for you, because sometimes the bosses are college educated and have little respect for people who are not college educated. So I brought this incident up to the union rep. And he advised me that what I should do is that if they ask me again, I just should let them know how I feel about it And judging, depending upon their reaction to it, if I'm not satisfied with their reaction, then I should go and, you know, talk to them, and they will have a word to say about it. And when I do join the union, because I'm still just waiting for that, just a matter of paperwork, I'm going to bring this up because this is something that, you know, I think we have to fight for. It's not as big an issue as pay and working conditions and stuff like that. But it's very, you know, when you work in a position, if you think you're working, doing a little extra, you think you would get a little extra recognition for it above and beyond just them making you do it all the time. And you hate to be put in a position where if you do something just to be nice, that the boss doesn't think there's a person who's taking initiative, we should keep an eye on this person for possible promotion or, you know, pay raise and stuff like that. All they see is, oh, look at this idiot. He's working here for, you know, a little extra. You know, let's see how much we can get out of him. You know, but, you know, I don't like to take that attitude. I really don't like to take that attitude where I'm only going to work at certain times and I'm going to be real strict about, you know, when my break is and when stuff like that. I like to be very flexible. You know, the line can be that way sometimes. Like today it started out crazy, but there were a couple of really large gaps because they basically ran out of parts to hang. So there's like 15, there's a couple of places where it's like 15 or 20 minutes and we're not hanging anything. And in fact, there was about an hour or so where we didn't hang very much at all. It was only a few random parts coming down the line because they were just waiting on boxes being built before they could hang them. So, you know, it kind of comes and goes like that. But the truth of the matter is you don't want to be in a position where you feel like if you do something extra, it's not going to be helpful to you. You know, you just, you know, I just want to come in and I want to be busy enough to be busy. I don't want it to be busy enough to be crazy. But how many of you out there, you know, email me, or if you're listening to the show and you want to make a comment on the blog, email me, talk to me, or just make a comment on the blog there and say, yeah, I had to do this crap all the time. In fact, my wife was telling me, you know, about when she was working where they found, you know, where she was helping out somebody else doing some stuff. And sure enough, you know, sooner or later, that was part of her normal job. Did they pay her any extra for it? No, of course not. You know, I get paid the same. I get paid the same $11.32 an hour, whether I pull, you know, 5,000 parts off the line or two parts off the line. It don't make a difference to me how many parts I hang. And you know something? The people who are putting this stuff up under pressure from the supervisor to hang more and more and more parts, they don't get any more money from hanging more parts. But of course, the supervisor gets a nice big fat bonus. When I worked for a printing company, and we had a salesperson there. And the salespeople there, we had one good salesperson and then three schmucks, basically. Schmuck isn't the right word. Assholes is the right word. And one of them was always promising the customer that certain thing would be done a certain way, a certain time. And, of course, it all comes back on us, the people who print the job, the people who would do the work in bindery and stuff like that. We're supposed to just, you know, work our asses off and to get this order done right. At best, we get a little bit of overtime, which means, you know, spending time on a Saturday when we can be doing something else. And they get a big fat bonus. Basically, we get dick, and we get dicked in that manner. So how many times has that happened to you all? You know, email me, comment, make a comment on the board. The email is joevec@bellsouth.net. And you can just go on the website, which if you probably know, cupojo.blogspot.com. If you don't know that by now, well, sorry. I don't know how you found out about this show without knowing about the blog. Maybe you got this from the White Rose Society, but they'll basically lead you there anyway. If you have something, put a note on the comment under the open thread for this show and just talk about some of the things that you've had to go through. And, you know, I've had a lot of different jobs. And I don't want to make it seem like I'm just putting it on the company I'm working for now, because it's not just them. I mean, they're no better or no worse than anybody else. Okay, people bitch and moan all the time about different things, and you know, and some, there are a few companies where things really do work well, and people have a nice working environment and a nice working relationship with their supervisors and stuff like that. And that's cool and that's fine, but those are definitely the exceptions and not the rules. The things that go on at where I work are not that much different from what goes on at pretty much every other workplace. Even, you know, I was in the military, and we even had stuff like that going on. And I'm going to talk about that in the next segment. But before I do, let's play a little music and We'll be back in just a few on the Cup of Joe Radio Show.
Help us feel our subway train. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they fought with
back to the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your host, Joe Vecchio. Vecchio, by the way, is Italian for old. And if you go to Italy, you'll see the word Vecchio a lot because there's a lot of ruins, especially if you're talking about the old Roman stuff, you'll see Vecchio. I actually lived in Naples for a year, Naples, Italy, or Napoli, as they call it in Italy. And there's a little town just north of Napoli called Arco Felice. And there's Arco Felice and there's Vecchio. Arco Felice, which is old Arco Felice. But at any rate, as I mentioned in the last segment, I am a veteran. I was in for 5 years, and actually I got out. I was supposed to serve six, but I got out because I had some problems with my weight. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I thought the Air Force's attitude towards that was very bad indeed. And, you know, basically I reached a point where I said the heck with it, and I gained a few pounds and just allowed them to discharge me. It was a general discharge under honorable conditions. And I got work almost immediately after I got out because I had a good job in the Air Force. I was in what they called PMEL, Precision Measurement Electronics, Calibration of Electronics Equipment. And it is a very well-paying job, I have to admit that. But it wasn't something I wanted to continue. And the reason was because it was driving me crazy. The job was boring. I was literally falling asleep at the bench half the time. And really, there's not much of a future in being a bench technician as a calibrator. Because you have pretty much two choices. You can be a bench technician for 20 years. Or you can be a supervisor for bench technicians. And that's really about it as far as calibration is concerned. So I got out of that. And I kind of futzed around a lot of different jobs over the years since I got out of the service. And I've taken a lot of crap for it from people, but I've also suffered a lot for it. But, you know, in the long run, I think it was a good decision, and I stand by it, you know, because the job was just affecting me. But the working conditions for military personnel aren't necessarily better than they are for us civilians, now that I'm a civilian. And the military in particular. And I want to talk about this because I'm a left winger, I consider myself a left winger because I believe in a good balance between government and private industry. I mean, left winger doesn't necessarily mean anti-government or, anti-business. It just means that, like with anything else, you need to keep an eye on people. You need to keep an eye on government, too. I'm not saying that we should let government run rampant over everything, and I think what the Bush administration is doing is letting federal government run rampant over everything, especially in the education area. But militarily, in this country, think about this. We spend over $400 billion a year. In fact, according to thing I got from TrueMajority.org, a very good website, they show our military spending. We actually spend about, we spend about $400 billion a year. And our allies spend $225 billion a year, according to this. That's a total of $624 billion. Russia spends $65 billion. China spends $47 billion. And the so-called Axis of Evil, or at least what used to be the Axis of Evil, Iraq is now, you know, our little colony, and Iran and North Korea, they spend all of $7 billion. So you're talking about, you know, being outspent over almost 100 to 1. But we spend more than $1 billion a day. Think about that, $1 billion a day, more than that, on our military. And you know what? Very little of that goes to the soldiers. I mean, if you read some of the news items I've read about, and I'm not talking about, you know, outlandish, you know, way off in the fringe websites. I'm talking like New York Times, CNN, you know, relatively legitimate news sites. And I say that because as far as I'm concerned, the so-called professional media has lost a lot of its credibility in my mind, but in my eyes. But there's still, you know, there's still legitimate sources for news in some instances. In this case, the soldiers at hospitals not getting proper care. In fact, there was some here in Georgia that were basically being screwed around. And you have problems with pay. There was an editorial in the Times about soldiers. There was a column in the New York Times about soldiers not getting proper pay. Because a lot of them are reservists, and they have an antiquated pay system, basically. And, you know, you have these guys that you're calling up, and they're not expecting to be called up for more than 6 months or so at a time. And they're there every, you know, year, 2 years. And, you know, it's not something they're not supposed to be doing. And because the pay system isn't set up to help that, you have a situation where sometimes they're not getting paid. And how ridiculous is that? Here you are sending these poor kids out there, and a lot of them, these kids are very young, under 20, a lot of them are. And this is essentially their part-time job. And, you know, while they expect to be called up, and that's fine, and I expect that, and I don't like it when reservists complain about getting called up, they do have legitimate points when they talk about their length of service and how they're being treated. And it's just ridiculous to just treat them the way they are. But that $400 billion, that doesn't go to help the soldiers. That basically goes to toys for generals and admirals, you know, fancy electronic gadgets and stuff like that, some of which is necessary, some of which isn't, and some of it is just, you know, pork and welfare for defense industry. Let me give you some examples, because when I used to work in calibration, I did also repair work of electronic equipment, and our supply system, the way the supply system was set up, was so screwed up. And let me give you an example. There was now, as you know, as some of you know anyway, who have been in the military, some of you veterans that are listening in, the military basically buys from the lowest bidder. But they're not looking at cost effectiveness when they're doing that. I'll give you the example I'm given is the Hickok 1507M multimeter. Oh, I remember that well. You might ask, how can I remember such a specific item? Yes, Hickok 1507-M. It's a multimeter. And a multimeter is a device that measures different forms of electrical power. There's, you know, it'll measure current, which is amperage. It'll measure voltage. It'll also measure resistance. You know, for multiple, and so on and so forth. Now, this thing was made by a company called Hickok, and it was a piece of crap. Literally, it was the most awful, horrible piece of equipment I ever had to work on. And one of the things we had, if we had a piece of equipment that we simply couldn't repair, it was too broken beyond our ability to repair it, we had a tag that we called NERTS, N-R-T-S, not repairable, this station. And these Hickok machines, every time they came in, the needle stuck, because it was what they call an analog meter, not a digital display, just a straightforward needle like you see in, you know, on a clock or something like that, but an analog needle, a meter, and the needle would stick. It was never accurate to within the standards it was supposed to be. In fact, when you put the little sticker on it, and you had a sticker that we put on that basically certified it, and I had to stamp it with my little stamp that said, I calibrated it, and I certify that this piece of equipment fits the specifications it meets. And if it doesn't fit the specifications, you can do what they say, redline it, which is basically you have a little comment section, and you put a little red line across the tag, and you write in the comment section exactly what the deficiency is. Usually, if something's like plus or minus 5%, but it's really basically only 10%, you can say plus or minus 10% in this area. Stuff like that. Now, these things, the needle always stuck. It was always like twice as bad as it's supposed to be. I think it was like in some areas like 5%, and it really was 15 or 20% in some cases. And I just got sick of it after a while. And what I started to do was, as soon as I saw these things go on the shelf, I would just immediately grab it and start filling out the NERTS paperwork for it. My theory behind this was that if we keep NERTS in these things, if we keep rejecting them, then maybe somebody will get to the point and realize that we don't want them. They shouldn't be out there in the field. I looked it up. These things cost something like $350. And there's another company that makes multimeters called Simpson. And they don't make the most quality stuff in the world, but they have a little, it was a 260, a little analog multimeter, which cost, I think, $70. It was just as good as a Hickok. The accuracy was just as good. Maybe not quite up to Hickok's supposed standards, but it was always better than what the reality was with those machines. But for what you're using an analog multimeter for, basically it was just fine. And it was fairly easy to calibrate. It was fairly easy to maintain. And you never had any problems with it. And we could have gotten a bunch of those. And my supervisor was getting on my case because I was filling out all this NERTS paperwork. And he said, why do you do this? I said, because this is a piece of crap. You know, in the Air Force, we have a term for stuff that's just useless item. We call them wheel chocks. And a wheel chock is something you put in front of an airplane's wheels to keep it from rolling around. But, you know, that's what we would call them. I said, it's a wheel chock, Sarge. You know, you just can't, you know, I'm not putting my stamp on this. And because it's unreliable, because the needle sticks, because it should never have been bought in the first place. And I'm trying to send a message here. And one guy was even, you know, one of my other supervisors was at the point where he was almost ordering me to put my stamp on. I said, no, I'm not putting my stamp on it. And, you know, they can't order you to do that. They cannot order you to do that because that stamp is your personal seal. And if something goes wrong with it, it's your ass. And I would refuse to put my stamp on something if I didn't think it was making the standards. And that attitude got me in trouble sometimes, but I simply wasn't going to do it. So, you know, they finally stopped letting me deal with these things. And I think actually they did stop getting those multimeters, and I'm glad for that. You know, And the thing about it is, like I said, they wanted just a simple analog meter. And, you know, the thing is, the Hickok was a plug-in meter. You couldn't even use it out in the field. You had to plug this thing in for it to work. The Simpson 260, it ran on batteries. In fact, it ran on a single, AAA? No, not a AAA. It was an A battery, or a C battery. It ran on a single C battery. And that was really all you needed. And the only thing that was for measuring resistance. Resistance, I don't want to get into electronic stuff, but that's only the only thing you're using the battery for. So that's all it is. And if you wanted a little more accuracy, Simpson made a nice little digital multimeter, a 360, and it gave a digital LCD display, worked very nice, and it had a longer, what they call a calibration period. In other words, there are certain items say, okay, after 90 days, you have to send it back to be recalibrated. And we had some items. Simpson was good. Fluke was very good. We had Fluke multimeters. They had... They had calibration periods of something like 180 days, which is like 6 months. You know, 6 months you didn't have to see these things, and they were super accurate. They were digital multimeters, and they were super accurate. And it's like, they should get more of these. And I would always say, look, they're very expensive, I agree. You know, they're like $250, $300 each. But you know what? They last forever, and they don't require – they hardly require any maintenance. I mean, 260s were great, but they tended to need a lot of maintenance. And these Hickox, of course, were just horrible. But, you know, I got in a lot of trouble when I was in the Air Force for a lot of different things. And maybe I wasn't the best person to join the service. But you know what? I'm proud of the fact that I made it through – because before I was in the Air Force, I was in the Army Reserve. And I made it through Army basic training, and I made it through Air Force basic training. And I went through some pretty tough schooling because in the Army I was in equipment repair 33 Sierra, which is a field they no longer have. Actually, they don't even have PMIL in the Air Force anymore as a military career. That's all done by civilians now. They have civilian contractors handle it. So, you know, it's but I just really got annoyed at some of the attitudes that the military had about how to deal with certain things, and it was so wasteful. You know, with the Hickok meters was just a perfect example. It was so wasteful, and it was so pointless, so much of it, that I just got sick of it after a while. So I allowed my, you know, the weight thing was a problem that I saw how in the Air Force how they dealt with it was just really bad. When I got in, I weighed about 150 pounds, okay? And my maximum allowable weight for the Air Force was 158 at my height. I'm only 5'2". I'm a little guy. And it makes it much more difficult. And I weighed about 150 when I came in, and I weighed about 160 when I came out. And actually, my weight really never changed that much all the time in. It only got up to 160 because I let myself go a little bit. And I was happy with the weight I was at 150. And actually, I did feel a little thin at that weight. But the Air Force wasn't satisfied, and they kept, you know, badgering me. They wanted me to be down to 135. I said, man, I've never been down to 135 since I reached this height. You know, this is the reality of it. And what upset me was that here I was a decent technician, and I would have been a very good career person, and I would have loved to have to be in the military as a career because I love to be able to travel. I mean, I lived in Japan for 2 years. I went to Montana for a couple of years, you know, and I enjoyed being able to travel around like that. And I probably would have stayed in, but the weight thing was just pestering me, and I finally said enough. And I let my weight go. And, you know, after I got out of the military, I gained about 40 pounds, and I now weigh about 210 now. But I gained a lot of weight very quickly, but I stabilized. And we're talking about 25, 30 years, I basically stayed the same weight. And I would have been perfectly happy staying at about 150 or so in the Air Force, but they just wouldn't deal with it. So, you know, I got out. And it's kind of a shame because I wish I could have made more of a career out of that. I would have been out by now and had a nice pension, but... You know, that's just the way things are. And it bothers me that we spend so much money on the military. And I'm not anti-military, you know. I mean, I still recommend the military. In fact, I tried to get my wife Kathy's oldest son, James, I tried to get him into the Air Force. He had medical conditions which prevented him from completing basic training. But I thought it would have been very good for him. He was just worried, you know, because he likes video games and stuff like that. He was worried that he wasn't going to find anybody who played video games. I said, man, you had no clue about the service, man. We used to play, went back in my, this is before, like, the big video games, back when I was in, you know, mid to late 80s. It wasn't so much video games, but a lot of people played, like, Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that on the weekend. Because, man, it's a great way to kill a weekend. It's not that we took it that seriously. It was just a great way to blow a weekend. And there's a lot of people in the military now who love to play video games and stuff. So I told him, I said, you know, just go ahead. You know, you'll meet friends. And he still has friends that he writes to from basic in the Air Force, and he keeps track with them. And that's really nice, you know. But anyway, enough of that rant. Let's have some music, and we'll be back with another segment of the Cup of Joe Radio Show.
Somebody's back for the rest of me. ship is soaked with the tears because the baby's life has been revoked. The bond is broke, got so choked up and focused on the close up, missed the wheels of can reform. No God like Hocus Pocus, so don't sit back, kick back and watch the world get worse. Crack news that's in your neighborhood is under attack. Put away the crack before the crack put you away. You need to be there when your baby's old enough to relate.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone in a time of need. Because he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and biting and riding on his horse. He's going the distance. No wine, he's haunted by something he cannot define. Bowel shaking earthquakes of doubt and remorse assail him, impale him with monster truck force. In his mind he's still driving, still making the grade. She's hoping in time that her memories will fade. Cause he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and fighting and riding on his horse. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's striving and driving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he's still.
I was young and was said these songs are true, these days are ours, these tears are free. The cross is in the ballpark, and the cross is in the ballpark. We had a lot of fun, had a lot of money. We had a little song we thought we'd call it Sunny. Sunny gets married and moves away. Sunny has a baby and bills to pay. Sunny gets sunnier day by day, by day by day. I've been following the light across my room. I watch the night receive the moon of my day. Some people say the sky is just the sky, but I say, why deny the obvious job? Why deny the obvious job? Sonny sits by his window and thinks to himself, how it's strange that some rooms are like his, yes. Sonny's yearbook from high school is down from the shelf, and he idly comes through the pages. Some have died, some have fled from themselves, or struggled from years. Sonny wanders beyond his interior walls, runs his hands through his spinning brown hair. Well, I'm accustomed to a smoother ride, or maybe I'm a dog who's lost its bite. I don't expect to be treated like a fool no more. I don't expect to sleep the night. Some people say a lie is just a lie, but I say the cross is in the ballpark. Why deny the obvious, child?
Welcome back to the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your humble host, Joe Vecchia. Before I go into this next little piece here, let me mention that my roommate and I went out on Saturday we went out to pick up my wife's medicine. She wasn't well enough to go travel herself. She had already called in the prescription, and we had to go up by in the area of what in the north perimeter, what they call the perimeter. Here in Atlanta, they have Highway 285, which basically is a highway that runs around the city, and that's called the perimeter. And the north end side, they have a mall up there, and they have a lot of hospitals right where the highway meets Highway 400, which is like a toll road that goes straight north out of Atlanta. If you have a circle with an X in it, and actually another straight across line. That's basically Atlanta's main highway system. The X, one road is I-85, one road is I-75, the circle is 285, and the east-west is I-20. And from the middle, if you look from the middle going almost straight north, that would be Highway 400, which is a toll road. Okay, anyway, we went up in that area, the north perimeter area, and to get my wife's medicine, we decided to stop off at a strip mall that we knew up there because my roommate wanted to go over to Office Max to pick up some stuff that he needed, some stationery supplies. And that store turned out to be closed, which was weird because Office Max is a pretty big chain and they were shutting this place down. One of the bigger stores, too. But next to it was a Best Buy. So I went into Best Buy, and when I got the new computer, or the used computer from Eric Wampner, He also sent me a check for $125 with which to buy a monitor. And I had been pricing monitors for some time, and I thought I'd go in there and see if I can find, you know, an LCD monitor, which is what I really wanted to get. And what I have been wanting to get, because, you know, the clarity of the picture and stuff like that. And plus, they're very thin and very space-saving, which, you know, in my small room environment here is very important. At any rate, we went up, and we were looking around Best Buy, and I was looking at the LCD monitors, and they're all like $200-$300, and I am not spending that much money on a monitor. I'm sorry, I don't have that kind of money to begin with, and I only really had $125 to work with, and I really didn't even want to spend that, but, you know, I would rather have that in savings, but if I found a good deal, and I would just, you know, I've gone through all the monitors that they had, and then I looked in to the area where they just had the computers, because I didn't really see any of the monitors that, not that I didn't see any that I didn't like, because I liked a lot of them, I just couldn't afford them. So I went over to where the regular computers are, and sometimes I have some monitors there, and I came across a monitor, very nice, Sony Trinitron, and I have a lot of regard for Sony. They make great TV monitors, I know that, and Trinitron is their highest caliber. 17-inch screen, and I was thinking, yeah, this is a real pretty monitor. Then I look at the price tag, $99. It was their demo model, their floor model. And I was floored by it. I said, this can't be right. $99, is that the monitor? I double-checked, and brought the guy over, and I said, is this right? This is $99. $99. I want it. It's mine. And I jumped on it. It is a really, really nice monitor, and I'm very happy to have it. It's a 1244 times 1028 resolution, something like that, which is a bit higher than what I was doing before, which was a 760 or something, you know, 800 by 600, bigger than the next one, biggest. 1024 by 768. This is even wider than that. And I finally feel like I have a real computer because the screen looks exactly the way I want it to be. The icons are smaller, it's more space-saving, and I just really like it. Much better, much clearer picture, and I'm very, very happy with it. And I'm very happy that I got this monitor for the price that I did. It was a great, great buy. I have noticed since I purchased it, and you really only notice it on a white screen, that there's two very tiny little lines across. It's like one strand of pixels is not getting refreshed properly. It might have to do with the refresh rate. I actually changed it from 50 hertz to 60 hertz, and it really didn't affect anything. So it also might be my graphics card. I really don't know for sure. At any rate, I'm very happy with the monitor, and I'm really, really glad I got it. Okay, where was I? You know, there's been a lot of talk now. You know, recently they had the elections in Spain, and the conservative prime minister of Spain, Mr. Aznar, who was one of Mr. Bush's big backers. Britain and Spain were the only two large, important European countries that backed us in a war with Iraq, and he lost his job because, as everybody knows, 3 days before the election was to take place in Spain, there was a big terrorist attack, over 200 people killed in a plane bombing, and the government originally tried to blame it on Basque, B-A-S-Q-U-E, separatists, and the Basque people are a separate ethnic group that has been demanding their own country for many years, and I'm not going to get into that too much. But they claimed that it was, the government at first claimed that it was those guys and was trying to insist it, and then it turned out to have been Al-Qaeda. And the people were upset about being lied to like that or being manipulated like that. And, you know, that's what these guys do. They manipulate and they lie. You know. So the socialists won. And these guys, you know, when you talk about socialists, these guys are socialists in the same way that the French and the Germans are socialists. They're not completely and totally, you know, into the government runs everything type of deal. They do allow some private industry, but they just regulate it a little more strongly. That's one of my definitions of socialism. It's where the government takes a bigger hand than under liberalism, though far less of a hand than under communism. Socialism, communism are not the same thing, but that's two completely different stories. At any rate, the spin that we're getting from the Bush cronies in the press and from, of course, the Bush hate machine is that by voting out the prime minister, they are appeasing the terrorists. This, of course, is pure bullshit. The Spanish people are for the war on terrorism. They want to fight terrorism because, as being Europeans, they have much more experience with it than we do. But they were against going to war with Iraq. And I don't understand why this is such a difficult thing for our press to comprehend. that there's a big difference between fighting the war on terror and going to war in Iraq. They're completely different things. Iraq had nothing to do with the war on terror. I honestly don't know what their real motivations were for going into Iraq. But the point of the fact of the matter is that Iraq didn't have anything to do with the war on terror, because Al-Qaeda was not there. They're there now. Osama bin Laden was not working with Saddam Hussein. In fact, the two didn't even like each other, because Hussein was a bastard, but he was a secular bastard. Bin Laden is fighting a religious war. And in fact, we did bin Laden a big favor by taking Saddam out. He was probably laughing his ass off all the time that was going on. So, it was an interesting report out of the BBC, talking about how the Spanish newspapers are responding to it. This is from the BBC News from Monday. It's actually now, well, officially it's Thursday. I've recorded this show over the course of like 2 or 3 days. And it's talking about how the main reason, where was that paragraph? The voters have savaged, this is from the pro-socialist newspaper El País, which called it a political upheaval, but added that the political system and democracy have been strengthened by these elections. It says, voters have savaged the politics of José María Aznar, who was the prime minister, and his successor, Mariano Rajoy, has paid the price. The rupture of political dialogue with the nationalists, foreign policy, and particularly the decision to take Spain into the Iraqi war, have all been soundly rejected by the electorate. Keep in mind, I should let everybody know, that about 80% of the Spanish people, and in fact probably about 80% of the British people, were against going to war with Iraq. And a sizable number of American citizens were against it, but we've been much more propagandized, and since, you know, because of 9/11 in particular, a lot more people were scared into thinking that this was a legitimate thing. But there were millions and millions and millions of Americans who were against the Iraq war, not because we want to be soft on terrorism, but because we just simply want to, you know, we want to fight it the right way. And, again, I can spend days and days about this. Now, you know, now, at this point, there's a presidential election coming up, you know, in November this year, assuming they let us have elections. I don't want to say I'm really concerned about that, but let's just say I wouldn't put it past them to attempt to cancel them or get rid of them altogether. I just wouldn't put it past them. And, of course, the presidential nominee is going to be John Kerry, senator from Massachusetts, whom I am not the biggest fan of, but, you know, I am anyone but Bush. That's my deal. Now, the Bush administration is campaigning based on terrorism. They're based on national security, and they're saying Kerry would be weak on terrorism, weak on national security. But when you really look at their record, and nobody really is looking at the record, at least nobody in the so-called legitimate press, nobody in the professional media is looking at the Bush administration's record on terrorism seriously. So let's take a look at what happened on their watch. And the first thing, during the transition between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, the Clintons knew and understood that terrorism was going to be a major issue for whoever was coming in again. And they had, in fact, had commissioned a report, which was written by a lot of very good experts, including Warren Rudman, I believe, and Gary Hart, the Hart-Rudman Report, detailing the threat posed by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And the Bush administration basically took this and said, yeah, whatever, and they sat on it for months. They did absolutely nothing. And I think it was in August that they finally started to have a couple of meetings about it, but they weren't really interested in it. In fact, Paul O'Neill talks about how very early on with the Bush administration, they were trying to figure out ways to invade Iraq. And when 9/11 came, I believe it was Rumsfeld was overheard saying into his tape recorder that they needed to find a way to trace this to Saddam Hussein. So they had the idea for going into Iraq long before 9/11. But basically they took this terrorism report and they just sat on it. They did nothing. And then 9/11 happened. And no one is really sure just what these people were thinking that day. First off, when Bush hears that a second plane hits the tower, he just sits there. He's in a schoolroom in Florida, and he sits there for 20 minutes listening to a girl tell a story about a goat or something like that. And then when he finally gets on a plane, he flies all over the place, ending up in Nebraska of all places. And you know, I know some conspiracy people who have a field day with that, because Nebraska is a hotbed for conspiracies. Far too many for me to go into now, but if you've ever read any of the conspiracy books that I've read, and some of which I believe is just total, you know, horse manure, horse shit, Nebraska plays very heavily into that. But at any rate, that's where he winds up in Nebraska. And, you know, the lies from the Bush administration about what was going on begin immediately. They claim that there was a threat to Air Force One, when there was no threat to Air Force One. They never proved that there was any kind of threat to Air Force One. And that was debunked almost immediately. But in the midst of all that was going on, it was quickly forgotten by the press and forgotten by the American people. Because, you know, 9/11, right? Everything changed. And, you know, and all of a sudden we had a man who's was hovering around 40-50%, you know, 45-50%, not really doing particularly well with the American people because the economy was going bad. And it didn't seem like he was going to do anything to help it out. Of course, there are a lot of people who believe that he caused a bad economy. But again, let's just say for the sake of argument here that he was not perceived that well. And all of a sudden, he was given almost godlike status. No one questioned anything that went on that day. No one questioned why Air Force jets were never scrambled when four planes were hijacked. And when planes go off course like that, big jumbo jets especially, the Air Force has special planes that go out there and take a look and make sure everything's okay. At the very least, they can fly around and report on what's happening, like what happened with that that one airplane, which wasn't even a big jumbo jet. It was a private jet. Who was it? That sports guy was on a golfer or something. And they basically, all they could do was follow it into the ground, but, you know, if they had a plane up there. No one questioned why those jets never flew that day. No one questioned Bush's contradictory statements about the events of that day. He said that he had seen the first plane fly into the tower, which couldn't have been true because that didn't show. You know, and then, you know, I remember seeing the video of him in the kindergarten class when this went down. And I remember back in the 80s when the Challenger, the shuttle, blew up. And that was under Reagan's watch. And I didn't blame Reagan personally for that. Although, you know, a case could be made that, you know, they were so anxious to get this thing up in the air that that they were ignoring safety warnings from Morton Thiokol. But I remember Reagan was in a classroom that day, and the shuttle blew up, and they showed Reagan's reaction, and he was like, holy shit. And he was like speechless, and the Secret Service came and dragged his ass out of there. I don't have a problem with that because, you know, it was a shocking event. And he was in there in a classroom because they had that lady teacher in there. Krista McCullough was her name, I think. But anyway, they had that teacher on there, so he was in a classroom, and his reaction was like, oh, my God. And I remember Bush's reaction upon being told about a second plane hitting a tower, and he was just like, yeah, whatever. And he just sat there, you know, he just kind of nodded his head and had this kind of blank expression like, you know, it really doesn't matter, you know. To this day, nearly 3 years after those towers fell, the administration is still doing everything it can to make sure no one ever finds out what happened that day. And, you know, and there was another thing. A couple of days after that, they took all the members of the Bin Laden family and other prominent Saudi Arabians and flew them out of the country. When air travel was restricted for everybody else, they picked these people up. This is not a conspiracy. This is a fact. This is what happened. And, again, no one really knows why. And, you know, the Saudis have their own ties to terrorism. I mean, the Saudis have been a big, not the Saudi royal family themselves per se, but Saudi Arabians have been big financiers of terrorists over the years, much more so than Iraq. Iraq paid some suicide bombers in Palestine because they sympathized with the Palestinians, but they never did anything on the scale that the Saudi Arabians did, that's for sure. Now, we then go on to invade Afghanistan, which was the right thing to do, but they left the job unfinished, and they allowed bin Laden to get away, and al-Qaeda, for the most part, a lot of their leadership, and all because they had their eyes on Iraq, and nothing, not even the safety of the U.S., was going to take their attention away from that. Fuck Saddam, we're taking him down. That's a quote from George Bush. We're taking him out, not taking him down. Doesn't matter. You know, they didn't just sex up intelligence. They didn't just build up things. They flat out lied about how dangerous Saddam was and threw away every bit of goodwill we had gotten in the wake of the 9/11 attack, accused anybody who contradicted them of being a traitor. Even the most benign statements, like Natalie Maines, "We're ashamed that the president is from Texas," got thrown into the same bin as saying, like, you know, we should go out and kill George Bush. I mean, that's they're just saying they was ashamed that he was from Texas. And all of a sudden, they're branded as traitors and having their pictures shown up with stuff. You know, that was the atmosphere. That's still the atmosphere today, to a certain extent. If you're either with George Bush or you're with Saddam Hussein or the terrorists. That's not even true. There's more options than that, aren't there? Of course not. And finally, almost a year ago, as we record this, we're getting on the anniversary of the attack. We thumbed our noses at practically the whole damn world and slammed into Iraq and proceeded to screw up the following occupation. Over 700 allied, and I use the term loosely, forces have been killed and thousands wounded in the year since. And because we were so busy in Iraq, we proceeded to screw up the occupation in Afghanistan, which hardly anyone's talking about. There's still shootings going on. In fact, a while ago they assassinated the vice president. And basically, the Taliban is on the rise again. From what I understand, they now control one-third of the country. And the U.S. really only controls a very small area around the city of Kabul and the city of Kabul itself. And that's really it. And now... we're finally seriously beginning the search to go get bin Laden. And I bet we'll catch him just in time for the November elections. In fact, I hear they're flying in some weapons of mass destruction to Iraq, too, just to be on the safe side. So they can say, oh, we found him. And meanwhile, Saddam Hussein, remember him? He's sitting in a jail cell, and he's getting better treatment than a lot of U.S. citizens are getting at Guantanamo Bay. In fact, they released, I think, five British prisoners. And within 24 hours of their being released, they were interviewed by Scotland Yard and by the British Secret Service, and they were basically cleared. They were innocent of any wrongdoing, and they spent how many years in a jail cell just tossed in there with no right to see a lawyer, no right to do nothing? Now, if the Bush administration had spent more time looking into terrorism before 9/11 and combating terrorism after 9/11 and less time lying about why we had to go into Iraq, we may have captured Osama bin Laden by now. But instead, they just sent more than 500 of our soldiers and uncounted thousands of innocent Iraqi citizens, most of whom hated Saddam about as much as we did, to meaningless deaths. And the world is a much more dangerous place than it was before. You know, we have a right to defend ourselves. We even have a right to strike back in revenge at those who attacked us. But we do not have the right to do whatever the hell we want just because we're the biggest kid on the block. The Bush administration is going to make the case that only they can protect us from terrorists, but it's obvious that they're just a bunch of incompetent jerks who don't know their ass from a hole in the ground. It's up to us to get rid of these clowns. It's up to us, and we're ultimately responsible. We are ultimately responsible because we're either not paying attention, we're actively supporting this slaughter, or because we don't care enough to get involved. It's our responsibility. Because the Constitution spells out very clearly the first three words, who runs the country? And it's we the people. It's us. Anyway, I don't want to end it on such a bad note like that, but I'm going to have to because I got to put this thing away so we can get it in the can. I'm glad you're listening. And I hope you do, as I mentioned in the first segment, give me an email, joevec@bellsouth.net, or comment on the open thread for this show on the blog. That's cupojo.blogspot.com. Y'all must know it if that's about the only way you can get to the show. But do me a favor, just let me know who's out there listening. And I know Ziggy's out there, and Carolyn C. is out there, and, of course, my old sparring partner, Beachon, is out there. And I know there's a few other people. And maybe I get Bart Cop to listen to me, but I doubt it. I'm not important enough for Bart Cop, unfortunately. But let's go out there and let me know and just who's listening and what kind of reaction I'm getting, so I just have a general idea. I know probably no more than a dozen people listen to the show, but you know what? I don't care. I'm going to keep doing this damn thing because I like doing it. And because I think it has to be done. This is my part. This is my way of dealing with these issues. So, y'all have a good one. I will see you at the next show. This is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show, signing off.
I was walking down the street on a sunny day. Hubba, 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 hubba. A feeling in my bones says I have my way. Hubba, 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 hubba. Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, ain't it good when things are going your way. Hey, hey. Yeah, my little dog Spot got hit by a car. Hubba, 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 hubba. Put his guts in a box and put him in a drawer. Hubba, 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 hubba. Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, ain't it good when things are going your way. Hey, hey. Forgot all about it for a month and a half. Hubba, 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 hubba. I looked in the drawer and started to laugh. Hubba, 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 hubba. Cause I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, I'm a happy boy.
Happy boy.
Oh, ain't it good when things are going your way. Hey, hey. Ba 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 ba